I'd like to thank you both for your interest in the inquiry and for your appearance at today's hearing. The purpose of this hearing is to assist me in gathering evidence for the Climate Health WA inquiry into the impacts of climate change on health in Western Australia. My name is Taran Weeramanthri, and I've been appointed by the Chief Health Officer to undertake the inquiry. Beside me is Dr. Sarah Joyce, the inquiry's project director. If everyone could please be aware that the use of mobile phones and other recording devices is not permitted in this room, so please make sure that your phone is on silent or switched off. This hearing is a formal procedure convened under Section 231 of the Public Health Act 2016. While you are not being asked to give your evidence under oath or affirmation, it is important to understand that there are penalties under the Act for knowingly providing a response or information that is false or misleading. This is a public hearing and a transcript of your evidence will be made for the public record. If you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that that part of your evidence be taken in private. You've previously been provided with the inquiry's terms of reference and information on giving evidence to the inquiry. Before we begin, do you have any questions about today's hearing?
No.
For the transcript, could I ask each of you to state your name and the capacity in which you are here today, and when speaking through the hearing, if you could briefly state your name for the purposes of the audio.
I'm Dr. Richard Yin. I'm the WA Chair of Doctors for Environmental Australia and also the Honorary Secretary.
Dr. George Crisp. I'm a member of Doctors for the Environment Australia and on the State Committee for WA.
Okay. Sorry, can I just clarify, because we've got your title there, DAWA. Are you the chair of the WA branch or the
national? I'm chair of the WA branch and the honorary branch.
Thank you, Dr. Crisp.
I'm a member or a representative for
Doctors. Thanks very much. Dr. Yin, would you like to make a brief opening statement?
I think the only thing I'd like to highlight is the urgency of this issue in terms of climate change and the fact that each successive report that comes out shortens our timelines and suggests that the impacts are much more severe. And so it imposed on us as health advocates in seeing this as a health issue to actually strive to make significant changes in our emissions and actually protect health through taking the necessary measures to actually deal with this problem.
Okay. Thank you. If I could just remind everyone that the audio is in front of you, if you just kind of project your voice so we could get a clear recording, that would be great. Thank you for your very comprehensive and well-referenced written submission and for taking the time to highlight issues relevant to Western Australia. We don't have time to cover all the issues you've raised in your written submission today, and you make a number of recommendations as well, which we've read. But I'd like to focus on some points you make that are not covered by other submissions. Firstly, can I ask you to highlight any environmental issues specific to Western Australia and broadly how they might impact health in this state?
Yeah, so there are a few things I could highlight here. I think that as elsewhere, I mean, it really does primarily relate to that accelerating departure from normal climatic conditions in both sort of temperature and precipitation and variability of climate. These can clearly directly affect health, you know, in terms of ambient temperature, air quality, and they can lead to more indirect, complex, and ecologically mediated impacts. That these things are clearly relevant to Western Australia. The effects of ambient temperature are quite well documented. We've got data on health outcomes in relation to ranges of metrics, including maximum mean temperatures, duration of temperatures, and those health impacts and mortality increase non-linear with increasing temperature and from quite a low threshold. We know far less about the actual individual components of that, so there's a gap. WA is warming and drying. There's already recorded changes in both of those, and it's quite foreseeable with increasing temperatures and drying that the health, heat-related mortality and morbidity will increase as a result, and probably non-linearly. In IPCC's fifth assessment report last year, WA was predicted to have more over 40 degree days than any other state in Australia. We are predicted by CSIRO to have about 500% increase with no mitigation by the end of the century to over 20 days in Perth. And over the state, between 130 and 190 million person days. So there is a, for Western Australia, there's a particular issue with heat exposure. Obviously, that could be mediated by a range of factors in terms of emissions trajectory in the future, and also, you know, what adaptation measures and better understanding of population and geographical risks, which currently are lacking. Similarly, there's a very likely increased risk from bushfires, both the natural bushfires and also activity to manage them through prescribed burns, which will increase both the potential for direct injuries and for worsening air quality, particularly across metropolitan areas, as the fire season is obviously lengthening and the conditions are generally worsening. We know that, that fires can be devastating and have protracted impacts on community health, documented both here with the fire in 2016 and in the eastern states. You know, the mental health costs in particular run into billions of dollars related to that. In Victoria, the intangible costs of Victorian fires of 2009, for example, were estimated to be $3.9 billion. And there's also a prospect of sort of increasingly overlapping and compounding effects on physical and mental health, you know, with the increasing likelihood of heat waves and severity and of bushfires and also of prolonged drought. This increases the likely incidence of, you know, these sort of compound effects occurring both simultaneously and consecutively, for which there is very little research. So in terms of indirect effects, these are also very likely in WA. We know that there are a variety of ecologically mediated effects that are possible, and we know that WA's ecology is sensitive. From a study of 2011 published in Nature, there were widespread and profound impacts across WA marine and terrestrial ecosystems with a 1 to 2 degree departure from normal in that year. And we know that many of these things could then lead to sort of changes in the transmission of infectious diseases, human and livestock, affecting food production and quality, and of course those consequent things. However, you know, those pathways are complex and really not currently quantifiable. So, you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty there, and that, as my colleague Richard Jens has said, that there is also this concern really about the timing and the urgency of these issues. The longer we leave it, the more delay that we have, the more underprepared and ill-equipped we may be in terms of responding to health impacts. So we certainly are in favour of, you know, research into all of these areas through either planning.
I might just pick up that issue about urgency, but also needing to do research or generate new information. So, and just ask you to think about whether, obviously there are impacts on health that have been described across the world. The question then becomes, to what degree do you need to replicate those studies in Western Australia, you know, and or balance that with a need to do research into the effectiveness of actions taken, for example, in the health sector. So given that there's, you know, what you've said about the time period ahead, where do you think the focus should be in terms of further work to understand either the health impacts in this state or the actions of the health sector? I'm genuinely not sure about that.
Yeah, we... The health impacts are dependent on a whole number of things. And if you look at climate-sensitive risk, and we look at just one indicator out of maybe 40 indicators, we look at something just like heat alone, this would give you some idea what we would need to do to determine the health impacts. We would have to develop and implement a standard definition of heat-related health outcomes, as well as standard methodologies for surveillance of outcomes and evaluations of adaptation, understanding risk factors for illness and death associated with both acute exposure to extreme heat events and long-term chronic exposure, which we don't get very much information. We'd have to quantify the combined effects of exposure to heat waves and ambient air pollution on excessive illness and death. We'd have to determine attributes of communities, including regional and seasonal differences, that are more resilient or vulnerable to adverse health impacts and heat waves, the health benefits of the use of environmental design to reduce high thermal mass for urban areas, for example, enhanceability of current climate models to capture the observed frequency and intensity of heat waves across various timescales to support weather climate predictions and use of heat early warning systems in decision making, evaluating heat response plans, focusing on environmental risk factors, identification of high risk populations, effective communication strategies, and rigorous methods for evaluating effectiveness on the local level. Now, we're talking about just one indicator, and we're not talking about how they compound when events occur that are not just to do with heat, but to do with drought, to do with bushfires, that might occur concurrently or at least in very close proximity to each other. The amount that we don't know is just staggering. And the sooner we begin this process, the better, and certainly there's some teams that are operating out of Sydney trying to do some work, and really it requires, I think, a collaborative approach across states and nationally to come to provide all the information that that should be collated.
And presumably it could also be an area where, say, a health impact assessment or other process in terms of trying to determine, well, what do we need to know and what research is missing, as a starting point.
Thank you. And just a note that, we will be making some broad recommendations in terms of these areas in Western Australia for further research and how that might be supported. But also there are national processes, as you say, and National Health and Medical Research Council are holding a workshop tomorrow, in fact, to look at their approach to supporting research into the environment and climate-related issues. So I think it's a good point to make that how we merge these things is an important design question. So in terms of going to that kind of international context, you mentioned in your written submission the COP24 Special Report on Climate Change and Health that was released by the World Health Organization in 2018. Could you briefly outline the process that led to this report, its main findings, and its significance for us in Western Australia?
So the special report comes at the request of the then president of COP23, the Prime Minister Bainimarama of Fiji, to the World Health Organization to prepare a report on climate change and health. And the report is based on contributions from over 80 health professionals, academic experts, representatives of civil society and international agencies who have worked on climate change and health for over three decades. It's a long report, and trying to summarise it within the time constraints of this hearing is not feasible, but here's some key points from the report. With the Sustainable Development Goals embedded into the agreement, the Paris Agreement is as much a health agreement and arguably the strongest health agreement undertaken globally. The health sector then should really be taking a lead role in advocacy. It outlines the strong linkages between climate change, air pollution and health, especially in developing countries. Air pollution kills over 7 million people annually, and 90% of the urban population of the world breathes air containing levels of outdoor air pollutants that exceed World Health Organization's guidelines. Now, in Australia, that figure is around 3,000 premature deaths annually, which is still substantial, translates to 8 deaths per day. And certainly reducing fuel combustion in transport, energy generation and industry would reduce these numbers. Now, there's a special mention in the report of the need to reduce emissions of short-lived climate pollutants. These include black carbon, methane, tropospheric ozone and fluorinated gases. These are highly potent greenhouse gases. Methane in the short term, that is the 20-year period, has a global warming potential of up to 85 times that of carbon dioxide. Addressing these short-lived climate pollutants would make a significant difference to mean temperature rises by up to 0.6 of a degree mid-century. Now, I'd like to highlight methane. Australia's fugitive emissions of methane are rising, as a result of our gas industry, both conventional and unconventional, and certainly that's the case in WA. We need to be doing our part in addressing this. This would require stricter emission guidelines from large emitters, not more lax guidelines. And we acknowledge climate change as a health issue, then industries which emit high levels of methane should be subject to health regulation, such as through a health impact assessment. The report goes on to say then, from an international perspective especially, there are massive health gains from tackling climate change. Meeting the targets of the Paris Climate Agreement would be expected to save over 1 million lives a year from air pollution by 2050, according to the most recent assessments. The same analysis shows that the value of health gains would be approximately twice the cost of policies. And the largest gains would be expected in China and India, which would generate even a larger net benefit by pursuing a 1.5-degree target rather than a 2-degree target. Now, these health gains of meeting even a 2-degree target would also significantly offset the costs in other regions, such as the EU and the United States. The report then speaks of the need to address the health risk of climate change by building climate-resilient health systems, and they provide framework for doing that. And then the need to mobilise the health community for climate action. And it notes that we are respected and trusted and are in direct contact with patients and directly witness and respond to the health impacts of environmental and air pollution and climate change. In the same way that the health profession raised public awareness about the health effects of smoking, they could engage the broader health community, civil society, and the public in addressing climate change. It then spoke of the need to ensure economic support for health and climate action. And of note is that often the benefits for health action against climate change are substantial and should therefore be included in cost-benefit analysis of economic policy decisions. I'd just like to highlight that fossil fuel combustion in Australia is likely to result in health costs estimated at between $11 to $24 billion annually. If this were factored into the cost of coal-fired power generation, it would substantially change the true cost of electricity from such sources and change the comparative cost when measured against renewable energy. And the final point from the report was the need to be tracking of progress and impacts of health. To health.
That's a very helpful summary, Dr. Yin. Thank you for doing that. So, I was struck by the characterisation of the Paris Agreement as a health agreement.
Yes.
And the implications that flow from that. And we just for the record, we use the presentation or the graphics in this report in our presentation to the public around the links, the direct and indirect links between climate change and health.
Yes.
So we found this as helpful as a kind of consensus understanding of those links. And the section on air pollution, it's interesting for the inquiry because these are global figures. The challenge for the inquiry is to translate it into what's relevant for Western Australia. So that's a thread of our work. How relevant are those exposures, figures and analyses to illness and death from air pollution in Western Australia? So that's something we're looking at specifically because you can't always just take the global and figures and apply them here. Do you have any help for us in terms of that, taking something global and applying it? You know, what does it mean for us here in WA, particularly around air pollution?
Yeah, there's a review of the NETM standards on air pollution. And DEA has made a submission to that inquiry, which is to vary the standards. And within that is a position statement that comes from DEA, along with a number of other health organisations, I think including the RACP, the Lung Foundation, and that resource is available on our website. It will detail some of the impacts of air pollution and some studies actually within Australia that highlight that even small changes would make a, in terms of air pollution standards, would actually make a big difference to health. While it's more focused on oxides of nitrogen and sulfur dioxide and ozone, I think it's still relevant and it's worth looking into.
Okay, great. In your submission, there's a section on climate-related litigation, which hasn't been wasn't mentioned by many other people writing to the inquiry. So this seems to be a rapidly evolving area, and recognising you aren't legal practitioners, could you give your view on whether and how the duties of directors or board members of public authority entities, as often exist in the health sector, are similar to or differ from those of private sector directors?
I think the key paper I would probably refer to is from the Centre of Policy Development discussion paper, Public Authorities, Directors' Duties and Climate Change, that was published January of this year. The Centre for Policy Development is actually an independent policy institute in Australia, and these were the key findings. Public authorities are important institutions for managing Australia's economy and are both potential contributors to climate change and subject to climate change risk. Public authority directors likely have duties of care and diligence to consider climate risk in their activities, which are at least as stringent as duties of private corporation directors. Despite impediments to enforcement, public sector directors are now increasingly likely to be closely scrutinised and held to account for climate risk management, especially given rising standards demanded of private corporations. I think the one sentence that summarises or one paragraph from that report states, as in relation to private corporations, directors of public authorities will be duty-bound to exercise due care and diligence in relation to foreseeable risk. As the Hartley-Hartford-Davis opinion has set out in relation to the Corporations Act, given the increasing accuracy of prediction models of the impacts of climate change to human societies, the physical and economic transition risk associated with climate change are reasonably foreseeable today and thus would fall within the scope of the director's duty of care and diligence. And I think that's all that I can say.
We'll hear from all health services in Western Australia in this inquiry, or government health services, and ask about ways to reduce emissions in hospitals. And already this morning we've heard about some exemplar initiatives from the Child and Adolescent Health Service. But just switching away from hospitals, what is the role of primary care in both mitigation and adaptation? And do you know of any organisations or practices in Western Australia that could be considered exemplars in this space?
I was wondering if I could have the opportunity to speak to one exemplar potential case within a hospital setting.
Sure.
Okay. I would like to present some preliminary findings from a large public health service in Melbourne looking into power purchasing agreements for renewable energy. The service has an annual electricity bill of around $5.5 million, which is about half that of the Children's Hospital and Charles Gardner sites combined. It currently sources its electricity from brown coal through a process that is negotiated by Victorian Health Procurement. Now, if it were to enter into a power purchasing agreement with a provider for renewable energy, as opposed to brown coal, the cost savings that have been calculated over a 10-year period has been calculated around 9% or $5 million, with a reduction in emissions and also other forms of air pollution through the avoidance of brown coal combustion and its health impacts. Now, while there are no doubt differences in calculations because of the different electricity generation costs between states and the discounted price agreements for large consumers, this should be a serious consideration and of a scale beyond just installed solar panels on rooftops of hospitals and make a significant impact on the sector's emissions. If it was that we were to source all the renewable and all our electricity within hospitals from renewables, I think the best guesstimate along with transferring fleets to electric vehicles, the emissions reduction would be in the order of 10%, you would have thought, roughly. So I just put that out for consideration. In regards to primary care contributes a small part to healthcare's carbon footprint, around 4%. So in regards to directly to mitigation, its contribution would be small. But there are other things that could be considered.
Well, I mean, I think the place that general practice does fulfil is really the sort of messaging and health promotion. You know, most health promotion and prevention happens in general practice and in doctors' waiting rooms and sort of directly between patients. So there's an enormous opportunity for general practice to be involved in. In sort of education, health promotion activities here, and so the question really is, well, how could that happen, and how could it be resourced, and how could it be organised in terms of, similarly to how other sort of health campaigns have been carried out previously. So the actual in terms of reducing general practice footprint is limited, but it's really the flip side of that in terms of what could it do in terms of reducing the community or raising awareness in the community and reducing health impacts across the community and gaining some of those health benefits across the community too, co-benefits.
I think the other side is that a support of primary care and an emphasis on prevention prevents unnecessary hospitalisation and a generated financial and energy costs because hospitals are energy intensive. And primary care is currently in the interface of our current health system for the initial diagnosis and management of a wide range of chronic diseases, including obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And there is evidence to suggest that a strong primary health care orientation within the health system is associated with reduced costs, increased efficiency, lower rates of potentially preventable hospitalizations, and better population health outcomes. So I think there's another direction where primary care has a part to play. In the top context of who's an exemplar practice, certainly within our practice, we spend a lot of time thinking about how we reduce our emissions. While the impacts are small, they still are a step in the direction, but there are limits without structural change and support across the primary care sector about how we might do this better.
Just to respond a little, so we will have the Australian Primary Health Association, WAFA, attending a future hearing, and we can ask them about some of those structural issues. And clearly, the sector isn't far advanced in this as a sector, and I don't think anyone's pretending otherwise. But the shift to prevention, as you said, is one of the biggest potential positive impacts on the environment if you could shift it from hospital to community care. And the sense of responsibility, I think, is not governed by your percentage of emissions. So just as the health sector may be 4-7% of all emissions, you could say, well, that's too small to make a difference, let everyone else do it. Mm-hmm. But if any one sector doesn't make the changes that are needed, the burden goes more onto other sectors. Mm-hmm. So everyone needs to play their part. And so I think, and equally, if primary care is 4% of all the health sector emissions, primary care also needs to play its part, even though it's 4%, because otherwise the burden becomes greater on everyone else. So we're just working through some of these issues. But I think, everybody needs to, every sector in health needs to look and see what they can do and support each other. But your point about, having a supportive structure as well is... are taken. You mentioned in your submission DEA's own proposal for an Australian Healthcare Sustainability Unit. I'm presuming that's a national body of some sort. Can you share any of the main elements of that proposal, how those elements might translate to a state body, and how national and state units might work together in the future?
So I suppose the model here is the UK Sustainable Development Unit, which is sort of, I suppose, the, the primary example here, and clearly we have quite a different sort of model of health care in Australia in terms of the way that it's divided up. It would still essentially be aiming at the same sort of goals in terms of trying to improve that sort of triple bottom line and improving sustainability, environmental, financial, and social things. But the inherent differences, I suppose, you can still sort of envisage a sort of broad set of priorities being involved in terms of consulting with health sector bodies, canvassing current and planned initiatives in relation to environmentally sustainable healthcare, developing the necessary metrics and benchmarks that could be used to monitor progress and improvements. And we outline some priorities in our proposal, which are also on our website, such as development of sustainability strategy for the healthcare, including preventative healthcare, primary community care and hospital care, researching and developing innovations that will improve sustainability in healthcare, social psychological research to understand behaviour, attitudes, policy research to clarify how design of health systems influences uptake of sustainable behaviour and innovation and others. I suppose the question in terms of how do you divide this up between state and national bodies, I think is probably beyond our immediate control. Obviously, it depends, I suppose, how this area evolves, and there is clearly a place for a state body because of the nature of health service, but that could be work in conjunction with or eventually be subsumed by a federal body. A couple of other things. I was going to say a couple of other things about a sustainable development unit is the we know that health is really very wasteful and very sort of inefficient at the moment. As David Pension pointed out in his talk, you wouldn't really invest in health on the basis of its sort of the way that it's structured as a business. There is clearly a lot of potential for improvements there. We know that, for example, many of the treatments that we use are not supported by evidence. In the US, for example, about 50% of their current treatments were estimated not to be supported by evidence, and about 30% of healthcare expenditure reflects care that is of uncertain value. And one aspect of this would be to look towards comparative effectiveness research as a methodology of looking at, well, how do we better spend or apportion the resources in terms of getting both value for money. But of course, unnecessary treatments result in impacts. And those impacts, through their emissions and other waste, means that is potentially causing harm. So that's something that is important from that perspective. So we certainly consider there's a requirement for structural change to our current treatment-oriented system, as we just mentioned, in terms of general practice, the non-communicable diseases, the sort of chronic diseases that actually take up a large proportion of management costs and pharmaceutical costs, in terms of prevention, we allocate less than 2% of our overall health budget. So there is a great sort of potential for changing care in that regard. Another aspect that can be looked at through a sustainable development unit, which is currently missing, is that the health service is a very big industry. As such, it has enormous. And because procurement is such a big part of its emissions and waste, the purchasing power can be taken advantage of. Power as a buyer, basically, the health service could quite clearly change the market in terms of environmental outcomes in supply chains, not just across the health service, but much more broadly. So we think there is great opportunity for the Australian health services as a group to impact environmental benefits across the community.
So, Dr. Chris, you raised this kind of big issue about anything that's unnecessary or duplicative or inefficient is actually, if you could reduce that, you'll reduce the environmental impact. Yeah. So some people might be not thinking environmentally, but might be just in health services trying to do that kind of work, whether it's on safety quality or good prescribing or something else. Have you thought about ways to engage the profession either directly through the environmental approach or indirectly through actually kind of reinforcing those bits of the system which would have a positive environmental impact, even though you're not thinking about that.
I mean, partly the whole idea around health sustainability is a centralization or coordinating of that way of thinking. And so that there's a repository of expertise within a group of people dedicated to actually thinking about that. Because it makes it really hard when other areas of the health sector have to think about that as well, or how you're going to coordinate all that. It almost requires one group thinking about how this can be affected across the whole sector, which is, I think, what the key thinking is behind a dedicated unit.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you, because I've 10 minutes left, I want to ask you to reflect on two things, please. One is your own experience in, I believe you share a practice or part of a shared practice in trying to become more environmentally friendly over time, because any lessons you have might actually go as well to the lessons for the hospitals. So you don't want them, for example, trying to report on stuff which is you've found is impossible to report on because the definitions or methodologies aren't clear. It would be an enormous waste of time for us as a inquiry to recommend something that is inherently problematic, and you might just be better off doing something else. So what are the challenges you've faced that we might learn from, but also broadly, Doctors for the Environment's been around for a long time, in terms of how you act together at this point of time to make the most change possible? Because frankly, you know, even if there were to be a sustainable development unit or some sort set up in Western Australia, you know, you can't put all the responsibility on that unit. How is that supposed to be structured, supported, interact in order to for everyone to be able to make the change needed? It's a big question, but yeah. You know, you don't want to jump from, you know, to a solution which says that unit will somehow fix a very complex health system. We've got to be realistic about this at every step. So there's two questions in there for you.
Well, if you look at the Sustainable Development Unit in the UK and how they actually gone about the job, it's much more like, first of all, there was some clarity as to the metrics that were going to be used. So something was benchmarked that they could then successively see that was going to be lowered. Then there was given scope for each of the health services to do something, right? And it didn't actually specify what they had to do. There was an idea that emissions reduction had to occur. There was a certain scope. There were some frameworks, a way of thinking about the problem, modules, and an idea around modules and how they could be implemented, that the proposal could come from the health services to what it was going to do, and then the metrics measured in some sort of way to support doing that. So it's not really that the unit by itself just dictates what's going to happen. It's much more that it gives a framework of thinking about issues, right, that invites then a health service to come up with solutions and a way through the benchmarking of metrics to actually see the reductions happening. So it's a more collaborative idea. And around that, it's also, I think, what David's really keen on is the idea that it's not as if we know how we're going. It's a clear idea is you go out with a vision for something and we believe that it's possible, and we engage with people and culturally and sort of bring them along to see what can actually be done. So I don't think it's necessarily that the repository of all solutions lies with this, but there's a way of thinking that's actually important. In terms of what occurs at our general practice and how it might translate to hospital, it's a little trickier because they're sort of different entities.
There have been some there have been some lessons. I mean, I think one of them is that when we started out our Green Practice initiative over 10 years ago, and things have changed incredibly in that 10 years from when we initiated it in terms of, you know, awareness and, you know, a lot of information around it. Obviously, being a small entity, we have very little power in terms of, you know, to change things. So we're very much at the mercy of, you know, of lots of other organisations, you know, who want to deliver things in plastic and, you know, send us unnecessary things. You know, we have no control. As a bigger organisation, obviously, you start to get much more control over things like that. I think one of the other things that's been really interesting is how people sort of respond to this. It opens up a dialogue in the community. It's been very visible, and so there's clearly been, you know, engagement in you know, locally in terms of the things that we've done, that it's enabled us to ask people, and I suppose for people to comment as well. So, you know, some of the sustainability activities around our practice, you know, have drawn in a lot of the community. So I think if you sort of find out as you go, but I think there's clearly a lot of opportunity that's being missed in terms of engaging local communities with health services and providing information and highlighting sort of synergies between some of these things in a local area.
In terms of making some direct actions, even in the context of waste management and separation of waste, which is a really key issue, I mean, the cultural shift that's required, even within our practice, is really small, to make sure that waste is separated appropriately and everyone understands that waste separation has been enormously difficult. So, you know, in terms of approaching something like that, it needs to be, especially in the hospital system, where there's a whole chain that is required to manage waste from, let's say, within the theatre to where it ends up. There's a lot that needs to have to culturally shift and to make that easy for people, that it's clearly articulated what needs to do what and processes that are in place that would support all that. So certainly, even now, we struggle. We really struggle with waste separation. And some clear guidelines about what constitutes infectious waste, I'm still not entirely clear which goes where. If I happen to dab a bit of iodine on a bit of skin, you know, where does the tray go? It becomes very complicated.
I think that's a big issue that's been raised a number of times. Mm. I don't think we're going to be able to, through the inquiry, deal with it, but I think we'll be able to recommend that a whole issue of the trade-off between infection control and single use and be examined in a lot more detail, perhaps even nationally, because it's bigger than just the state. But there's a lot of implicit assumptions that perhaps were justified some time ago, which have kind of been built into the historic practice now. And people don't even know why they're doing it the way they're doing it, and whether it's for convenience or for infection control or for whatever, and we need to rethink that now.
I think also if hospitals were to be running on renewable energy, it would change some of the metrics around comparing sterilizing as opposed to buying disposable. So they would shift that cost benefit. They would shift a number of things around emissions, right, in the calculation of what's more emission intensive, whether it's to actually sterilize or use packaged stuff, and that would change the equation. So there's another reason for going down that line, in my mind.
We've just got a couple of minutes, and before I close, would you like to make any final statements?
I'm really, in the context of the research, it's just imperative. It's imperative in terms of getting more data, that we're better resourced to entering this next decade or so, or into the future, that we start treating seriously what are potential health impacts. Because it's a recent article, a series of articles from the New England Journal, that clearly states that we're going to be uncovering a whole number of health impacts that we never even knew related to heat. For example, chronic kidney disease of unknown origin, which is just emerging as a phenomena. It's a huge phenomena in terms of millions of people impacted. We know that heat plays a part in it, and probably dehydration plays a part, but there's also things that we don't know. It's unlikely that we're going to uncover more illnesses that are actually heat-related. To make sure that we're ahead of the game rather than behind the game is really important. So the more money that we can spend in this area, the more push that we can get for research, I think the more important, the better prepared we'll be in addressing these health concerns.
Thank you both, Dr. Yin, Dr. Chris, for your attendance at today's hearing. A transcript of this hearing will be sent to you so that you can correct minor factual errors before it is placed on the public record. If you could please return the transcript within 10 working days of the date of the covered letter or email, otherwise will be deemed to be correct. While you cannot amend your evidence, if you would like to explain particular points in more detail or present further information, you can provide this as an addition to your submission to the inquiry when you return the transcript, noting that you've provided us already with a very comprehensive and detailed submission. Once again, thank you very much for the evidence.
Thank you.